It is Friday, October the 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the humanitarian crisis in Syria. Also ahead, the plight of migrants in Rome shelters.
These migrants were actually sleeping outdoors, and there were men, women, and young adolescents there without their parents, and that's very disturbing. It's a very disturbing picture when you think about that.
Climate change also ahead, plus a huge hurricane headed toward the U.S. state of Florida, and a new film out there. It's called The Girl on the Train. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A senior U.N. official is warning that eastern Aleppo could be obliterated by the end of the year unless Russia and Syria halt the relentless bombing, which is turning this ancient city into rubble. Lisa Schlein has the latest at the U.N. in Geneva.
U.N. Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, says eastern Aleppo's 275,000 people are hanging on by a thread, and the ability of the city to survive the constant aerial bombardment of the past few weeks is in doubt. He warns Aleppo may be totally destroyed if the battering continues over the next 2.5 months. He says thousands of people will be killed and many wounded. He says thousands of others may flee and become refugees.
This is what you, we, the world will be seeing when we will be trying to celebrate Christmas or the end of the year if this continues at this rate. Unimpeded. This cannot be an option that we can just passively wait to happen.
De Mistura says Russia and Syria are using the presence of fewer than 1,000 al-Nusra terrorists in eastern Aleppo as an excuse to keep bombarding the city. He also condemns the militant group for essentially holding 275,000 people hostage until its demand for safe passage out of the city is met. The UN Special Envoy for Syria says he has no contact with al-Nusra, but he says he wants the group to know if it agrees to leave eastern Aleppo, he will physically accompany the fighters out of the city. In return for this, he puts the Russian and Syrian authorities on notice. They, too, must make concessions for the sake of the beleaguered residents.
Are you really ready to continue this type of level of fighting using that type of weapons and de facto destroy the whole city, eastern city of Aleppo, ancient city of Aleppo, with its own 275,000 people, for the sake of eliminating 1,000 al-Nusra fighters?
De Mistura says Russia and Syria should immediately halt all bombing if al-Nusra withdraws from the city. He says the Russian and Syrian allies should ensure that the local administration in Aleppo remains in place. He urges them to agree to a UN international presence, opening the possibility of delivering humanitarian aid. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Among some of the stories we're following here on VOA, Chinese national jailed for stealing U.S. trade secrets, Pakistan passes an anti-honor killing bill, plus Mugabe opening the Zimbabwe parliament. More on those stories, a lot more, at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This week saw one of the busiest days of migrant rescues at sea, the Italian Navy and the Coast Guard rescuing thousands of migrants between Libya and Italy. Rome-based reporter Josephine McKenna is following migrant developments and speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis about it all.
Well, this was one of the biggest days that we've seen in the summer months. 6,000 migrants rescued in a huge day of rescues off the coast of Libya, between Libya and Sicily. 9 bodies were also recovered. This occurred on the 3rd anniversary of the tragic boat sinking, which saw more than 360 migrants killed off the coast of Lampedusa just 3 years ago. Around 40 operations involving the Italian Coast Guard and several NGOs to save the lives of these migrants, which also shows you just how many are still trying to get to the coast of Italy. And there seems to be just a small window of opportunity now before the winter months set in, and perhaps that's why we're seeing such high numbers.
And I also understand that President Mattarella, he's urging the EU to do more in addressing the migrant issue. So what is he urging them to do?
Well, as we know, there is a debate in Europe about who should be shouldering the burden for the migrants. And Italy, for some time, has felt that it's bearing too much of a burden. The Italian president, Sergio Mattarella, is urging the European Union to do more, to make sure that the numbers are shared around, that there is more done to help them in terms of their welfare. And we're seeing that as there's greater pressure on the French and also in Hungary to restrict the numbers of migrants, to apply quotas on immigration. Italy is still looking for more leadership and someone to take charge in terms of sharing that burden between different countries.
To add more fuel to that fire, we have Monsignor Nunzio Galantino. He is head of Italy's Catholic bishops, and he has some words for Europe regarding the migrants.
The Italian Catholic Church has been very active in throwing open the doors of convents and monasteries to host migrants. And we saw some very strong words from Monsignor Galantino, who was saying that Europe is weak and blind for trying to build walls to keep migrants out. And this is consistent with Pope Francis' message, who, as we know, has been very strong about supporting migrants, about having an open heart, about doing more to share their concerns and make sure that they're made welcome in European countries. So it's interesting that the Catholic Church in Italy is also supporting this sense of integration and saying that it's fundamental, because you can't save people's lives and then not help them build a future.
You visited a migrant center in Rome. You were able to even speak with some of the migrants. So can you tell us about your visit and what did the migrants have to say?
This was quite shocking to actually step inside what I thought was going to be a migrant center, but in fact it's a small alleyway not far from Rome's central station where 250 migrants were sleeping every night. I met migrants from Ethiopia, Eritrea, and the Sudan region. They were very disturbed. Many of them have taken that very dangerous journey across the Mediterranean in boats. Some had traveled overland through other European countries. Very young men, aged in their 20s, who told me they were escaping from Eritrea and were afraid of Al-Shabaab, the Islamist terror group. And for that reason, they didn't want to give their names. They were worried about their families, also terribly worried about their future. They don't know what kind of future that they can build in Europe. They felt that they weren't being welcomed in Italy and were terribly insecure. And since then, the Italian police have actually moved into that center, and I understand have moved around 100 migrants to other parts of Italy, to other migrant centers, to try and get them off the streets. But these migrants were actually sleeping outdoors, and there were men, women, and young adolescents there without their parents, and that's very disturbing. It's a very disturbing picture when you think about that.
That is Rome-based reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. International climate change agreement reached in Paris last December will be going into effect on November 4th after European nations, Nepal, Canada, and Bolivia joined dozens of other nations, including the U.S., India, and China, committing to that agreement, thus reaching its threshold of 55% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions said to cause global warming. President Obama said this week's achievement is a historic in the fight to protect the planet for future generations.
10 months ago in Paris, I said before the world that we needed a strong global agreement to reduce carbon pollution and to set the world on a low carbon course. The result was the Paris Agreement. Last month, the United States and China, the world's two largest economies and largest emitters, formally joined that agreement together. And today, the world has officially crossed the threshold for the Paris Agreement to take effect. Today, the world meets the moment. And if we follow through on the commitments that this Paris Agreement embodies, history may well judge it as a turning point for our planet.
Paris Agreement seeks to curb the rise in global temperatures to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Frank Yazzo is an associate professor and director of the Climate Center of Economics and Policy at Australian National University. He attended the Paris meeting, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty involvement of major countries represents a global consensus that climate change needs to be tackled decisively. He said the agreement carries few concrete legal obligations.
And that, of course, is part of its recipe for success and the explanation why, in fact, it is acceptable to all of these different nations and why they have ratified it. It is more by way of a declaration of intent to take action on climate change and not at all by nature of placing specific obligations on specific countries. We have now entered a phase where global climate change policy is very much a bottom-up process of recognizing the efforts and pledges that individual nations make in their individual circumstances and fully determined by national governments. This is a much more viable way forward for solving a global problem than any attempt of imposing top-down obligations on individual nations, which those nations then might not choose to follow through with.
The Paris Agreement does have a goal of limiting a rise in world temperatures to, quote, unquote, well below 2 degrees Celsius. What does that mean practically for each nation?
Achieving that goal would mean a drastic turnaround in global emissions trajectories. And to be frank, we're quite far away from achieving that kind of outcome. It is really a stretch goal. One that is still achievable, but it will require much more decisive action by most countries in the world than has been taken today. So it really needs to be understood as an ambition rather than a goal that is imminently to be achieved.
Will this crimp global economic growth at a time when most everybody, including organizations like the IMF and World Bank, are predicting weak growth worldwide?
The understanding these days is that taking action on climate change is what is needed to safeguard future economic growth opportunities. And in the near term, more and more governments are seeing the opportunities in the increased investment that a transition to clean energy in particular can bring. And so any sacrifices that might be made in terms of less productive energy provisions are probably going to be very small compared to the environmental benefits that come out the other end.
That's Frank Yazzo. He is associate professor and director of the Climate Center of Economics and Policy at Australian National University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Government of Haiti has announced its hurricane death toll now has risen well past 250. Some are reporting as high as 290. As search and rescue operations continue following Hurricane Matthew's assault this week, International Edition's Lori London speaks with Norrin Hatchern. He's a senior International Emergency Field Operations Officer with the Red Cross about their work to help the people in Haiti.
It's a major disaster. It's the largest disaster since the earthquake in 2010, and it's the largest storm in the last 50 years. It looks like there's a tremendous amount of need. Over 350,000 people are in need of assistance. We're looking at over 16,000 people have been displaced. There's 152 shelters open. And in some of the southern areas of the island, about 80% of the homes have been damaged. There is major flooding and damaged infrastructure, especially in the south, as well as major crop and garden loss, which is guaranteed to have a long-term effect on folks in that area. At this time, the major needs are around shelter, clean water, sanitation, and of course there's a bunch of health concerns regarding waterborne illnesses. It's the kind of disaster that we really try to rally around, and we're all looking to help out the Haitian Red Cross as much as possible.
What are the plans for the American Red Cross regarding this disaster?
The Haitian Red Cross is active all over the affected area, and the American Red Cross has been in Haiti for several years, and we have a very, very strong relationship with the Haitian Red Cross. Our job is largely to support them as they respond. We have a range of different activities underway. We're already working with a bunch of partners in the area, as well as the Haitian Red Cross, to conduct assessments. We're mobilizing the international community, as well as providing coordination services. It's, as I mentioned, it's a major response, and we're in the middle of it as we support the Haitian Red Cross.
What specifically do folks need? I know a lot of people, must be thousands displaced.
Absolutely. As of right now, and the numbers keep changing, of course, because we're in the early days of a disaster, we're looking at over 16,000 people have been displaced in Haiti alone. As I mentioned, the key needs at this point are shelter, clean water, sanitation facilities. As I mentioned, the health concerns regarding waterborne illnesses are absolutely something we're keeping a close eye on.
How many people do you actually have on the ground there from the American Red Cross?
Our delegation has approximately 200 or so employees, and we're kind of spread throughout the country. And while it's only 200 employees, the Haitian Red Cross is a giant network of volunteers. They're very, very strong, and we're proud and happy to be able to support them.
And of course, I know there are probably, you've got tons more people here in the U.S. preparing for what could be here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Our domestic side is very, very busy mobilizing resources and staff and preparing for an event in this country as well.
Noan Hatchern is a senior international emergency field operations officer with the Red Cross. He was speaking with my colleague Lori London. At last note, the eye of Hurricane Matthew was located over the western end of Grand Bahama Island, moving toward the northwest at about 20 kilometers per hour. The highest sustained winds have varied, but they're around 210 kilometers per hour. This general motion to the northwest is expected to continue for several more hours. And on the forecast track, the eye of Matthew should move away from Grand Bahama Island for the next few hours toward the U.S. state of Florida. They're a little unsure what's going to happen after that, but they do expect it to hover over Florida for a while, maybe even into the hours tonight. Further movement up and along the U.S. East Coast is expected, but forecasters are reluctant to say much about that right now because there is another tropical system, Hurricane Noel. It is out to the east of Matthew in the Atlantic. Hurricane Matthew is among the top items, as you might imagine, trending on social media. Our expert, Giabi Lee, is here with the latest.
Hi, Steve. Hurricane Matthew is trending online for two reasons. First, because it caused massive damage in Haiti. The death toll there is at least 108 people, and local officials say more than 28,000 homes have been damaged. Jacqueline Charles, who is a reporter with Miami Herald, has been tweeting a lot on location, and if you want to check out photos and videos from her, her handle is at Jackie Charles. Another reason the hurricane is trending is because it's projected to pass through Florida this weekend. The AP tweeted, "As Hurricane Matthew nears Florida's coast, Walt Disney World, Universal Studios, and SeaWorld shut down."
You know, gee, those are big destinations for people, not only in the United States, but from all over the world. Walt Disney World, Universal Studios, SeaWorld, amazing destinations. I'm sure everybody's hoping that all of those things are not harmed in any way and no one is hurt who works for them and maintains all of that. Got to be some other stuff out there trending. What's happening?
More than 14,000 people on Facebook are talking about a segment from The O'Reilly Factor on Fox News. And it's in the hot seat for taking a trip to New York City's Chinatown and spewing racist remarks on camera. The host is Jesse Waters, and he asked Chinese Americans there whether they know karate, which is a Japanese sport, and also to take care of North Korea for us. So here we have to wonder what the us means and why the Asian Americans who are citizens here are not included in the us. CNN national politics reporter MJ Lee tweeted this. This was in Chinatown, New York, and yet these people are being caricatured as though they're all foreigners. Because obviously, if you look Asian, ellipsis. Many lawmakers also condemned the segment, with a senator from Hawaii saying this. Jesse Waters is unfunny and mean. He should be ashamed of himself. Also, he's not welcome to Honolulu, Chinatown. Jesse Waters, for his part, sent out two tweets. He tweeted, "My man on the street interviews are meant to be taken as tongue-in-cheek, and I regret if anyone found offense." Now, a lot of people are saying that that's no apology, because you're saying, "I am sorry if anyone found it offensive," but it shouldn't be. His second tweet reads like this. "As a political humorist, the Chinatown segment was intended to be a light piece, as all Waters World segments are." Jean Park, who is a social media editor at Washington Post, replied, "Humorist is giving yourself way too much credit." Steve, back to you.
Many thanks to UG International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
In 1940, a single farmer could feed 19 people. Today, that same farmer can feed more than 150. Technology, a major reason, and the latest technology that might hit the farm is something called the SwagBot. It's a four-legged, four-wheeled vehicle that can do a variety of time-saving tasks. Robotic expert Salah Sukaria at the University of Sydney.
The thing that growers are most interested in are animal welfare and looking at pasture quality or pasture quantity.
The unique feature of the SwagBot is its omnidirectional movement capabilities, powering it over almost any terrain to check fence lines, herd cattle, and move equipment. And on a 5,000-hectare farm, that's a lot of terrain for farmers to cover.
Agriculture has opened up as a potential another area where robotics could be used, because there's very low margins in agriculture, so you really need low-cost robotics or low-cost systems there.
The SwagBot could be ready for production in just 3 years. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. A new thriller, a film starring Emily Blunt, Justin Theroux, Luke Evans, and Laura Prepon, The Girl on the Train, takes audiences on a wild ride, so to speak, trying to figure out a murder mystery. International Edition's David Byrd tells us the movie touches on several very powerful themes, including addiction, adultery, and revenge.
I saw someone with Megan Hipwell, but not on Friday night. She was having an affair. She had a lover. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
I thought you didn't know her.
No, but I saw her.
You saw her where?
I saw her from the train. She was standing on the deck with this man.
With her husband, Scott Hipwell?
No, it wasn't him. This man was different, and they were kissing.
Rachel Watson is an alcoholic who lost her job and her marriage and develops an obsession with her next-door neighbors. Rachel, played by Emily Blunt, takes the train past her former home every day, and from there spies on her ex-husband, Tom, who's played by Justin Theroux, and his new wife, Anna, played by Rebecca Ferguson. But one day, Rachel sees something from the train, a young woman she thinks she knows, with someone else. Is it Anna, or is it Megan, her ex-husband's nanny, played by Haley Bennett? When Megan turns up dead, the twists are on. Star Emily Blunt said at the New York premiere that the film plays into the dark desire of voyeurism and spying on others.
I think we've all got sort of voyeuristic tendencies to varying degrees. But I think that idea of seeing behind closed doors, seeing what we shouldn't, is sort of tantalizing for everybody.
Laura Prepon plays Kathy, Rachel's friend from college and current roommate. She says that the story touches on the voyeuristic element sometimes found in social media.
It was an amazing article about how people are obsessed with their phones, and it's that thing of needing to be connected and into other people's lives and worlds and whatever. I don't know what that is. I definitely think it's at its peak right now, for sure. So I think the film is coming out in a very appropriate time.
Edgar Ramirez plays Dr. Kamal Abdich, Rachel's therapist, who was also treating Megan. Ramirez says he thinks there's a big difference between voyeurism and following people's social media feeds.
Yeah, but the thing is that, the social media, in many ways, the information can be manipulated or changed or groomed in a way. It's the way you want to be perceived. But voyeurism is normally, you know, it's a candid eye. You know, it's when you look at things without, while the object of your observation is unaware. And I think that's what makes it, you know, more fun.
Director Tate Taylor says that he abstains from social media because people have taken it too far. They've forgotten empathy with others.
I personally don't participate in social media. I think it's gone beyond voyeurism. I think we've, in many ways, lost the art of communication and empathy, and I just think it's interesting. I think it's gone beyond voyeurism. We've kind of lost our humanity, in my opinion.
The girl on the train is rated R for violence, language, nudity, and sexual content. It opens in U.S. theaters during Domestic Violence Awareness Month. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
One other story for you, a new museum that seemingly rises out of the ground, literally with grass on the top of it, replaces the small exhibition space inside the pedestal at the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. Officials unveiled that design of the new museum. It is a groundbreaking ceremony. It happened on Liberty Island. 4.3 million visitors a year come there. The museum is expected to open in 2019. It'll be about 2,400 square meters, constructed of glass, granite, concrete. Supposed to be a very nice place. It's going to cost $70 million. You got a dime or two? Let's give them some, huh? Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. So good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Partnership makes all things possible. The people of Burundi have greater access to life-saving medicines with the assistance of the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced the successful completion of 2 5-year projects aimed at enhancing the supply of essential medicines for malaria and HIV/AIDS in Burundi. During the project closeout event, which took place in Bujumbura, USAID Country Representative Victoria Gellis praised the efforts of all partners in strengthening the health system and reiterated the commitment of the United States government to support Burundi to meet the health needs of the people. Through the two projects, Systems for Improved Access to Pharmaceuticals and Services, or SIAPS, and Supply Chain Management System, or SCMS, the United States government collaborated with the government of Burundi, Management Sciences for Health, and other partners to produce and distribute essential medicines and supplies for HIV/AIDS and malaria, including 9 million ACT drugs for malaria, 7 million rapid diagnostic test kits for malaria and HIV, and diagnostic supplies for laboratories. Implemented by Management Sciences for Health, the SIAPS and SCMS project supported the development and rollout of a logistics management system that provides timely information about the inventory and consumption of commodities at districts and health facilities. The project also supported the upgrade of the National Pharmaceutical Warehouse to prevent the unnecessary expiration of essential drugs and commodities by improving the storage and management practices of the warehouse. The U.S. government, through USAID, provided more than $18 million U.S. dollars over 5 years for the procurement and distribution of health commodities in Burundi through the SCMS and SIAPS projects. The United States government provides more than $40 million U.S. dollars annually to support HIV/AIDS, malaria, nutrition, and family planning programs in Burundi. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Burundi, to help meet the health needs of the Burundian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for, what's your